I think humility is important because Silicon Valley can be a little bit douchey. Tech can be a little bit entitled. And it's important because when you're a CEO, you get surrounded by people who want to give you good news.
Hey, this is the Built in Seattle podcast. I'm Adam Schoenfeld. On this show, I chat with Seattle's best entrepreneurs, operators, and investors about how they think and how they operate. On this episode, I met with Glenn Kelman, the CEO at Redfin. You probably know Redfin. They've been called the Amazon of real estate. Glenn's been the CEO at Redfin for 14 years. It went public in 2017, and at the time of this recording, they're at about $2 billion of market cap. In this conversation, we got a little behind the scenes on how Glenn thinks about humility, company culture, running board meetings, and what it's like 14 years into his journey. I absolutely love Glenn's energy and his leadership style. I think he's very unique in how humble and authentic and real he is. So I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm sitting here with the one, the only, Glenn Kelman.
Oh, yeah.
We're in Redfin's amazing office.
Amazing.
This is technically South Lake Union, right?
It's kind of in between downtown and South Lake Union.
You have a great view of the Amazon buildup out these windows.
Not for long. They're going to build all those buildings, and then we're going to just be staring at other people working.
I've been a fan of yours ever since we met back in about 2007.
Oh, it's mutual. It's mutual.
At that point, you were just a couple years into building Redfin, and now it's been about 14 years.
I want credit for time served, baby. It's been really fun.
Not very many entrepreneurs get to experience that long of a run. I'm curious, how does that feel when you think about that 14 years of building this and obviously a lot of success, but that time period, how does that feel to have come that far?
Well, it's a deep sense of belonging more than anything else. If I didn't feel like I belonged here, I couldn't have stayed so long. It's been exhilarating and fun and humiliating and weird. And I've had to be a different CEO every year because the company is different every year. And I think if I ever felt like I was the perfect CEO, well, then I could stop. But I always feel like, I still have so much that I want to do better at. I have so much that I'm working on that I just got to keep doing it. So for me, I can't imagine anything better. I really can't.
So how do you keep motivated after all that time?
Oh my gosh. I don't feel like we've really accomplished everything that we wanted to. Redfin's mission is to redefine real estate in the consumer's favor, and we have 1% market share. So I wake up every morning kind of ticked off that we haven't done more. And so I feel a sense of outrage or indignation or stymied ambition. And I know that I'll never get a better shot at the title. So I still feel kind of feisty about it, not satisfied. I think you can get too much success early in life, and then what are you going to do for your second act? And I haven't had to worry about that. It's been a lot of success, but still a lot of struggle and failure and obstacles to overcome, and that's the perfect balance for me.
That's awesome. So it still feels like, that 1% number and 99%, it's like daunting.
It is daunting, and I think the other side of it is that I really do feel like I'm not the CEO I want to be. I remember when I was in elementary school, I think it was fourth grade, I came up to all these kids at the beginning of the school year and I said, look, I'm really sorry. I used to be a total dork, but this year I'm going to be cool. And that's how I start every year as the CEO. Where I think this is the year that I'm going to be a really fantastic CEO. And I feel so excited that I get that shot. If I ever got taken out of the game, if I ever got fired, if I ever lost my job or moved on, I would always have to think, man, I still never quite got it right. And so for me, I'm still trying to be the best CEO that I can be.
So what is it this year that you're working on to be the best CEO?
I think part of it is that I have the tendencies of an operator where you try to optimize and perfect and you work on how well you execute. And I'm just trying to also be an allocator of capital, which is how an investor thinks, where you don't think about whether you can do something better or how you can do it better. You think about, should we be doing it at all? Because there's thousands of people now at Redfin who are counting on me to make sure that we are hiring people into the right jobs and asking them to do the right task so that it all works out well for Redfin. And sometimes instead of being that strategic allocator of capital, I sit there and say, oh, well, let's rearrange these pixels on this website, and that is the key to Redfin success, and that's somebody else's job, and they do it better than me anyway. So it's not just about delegation. It's also about thinking about where you really apply your energy, and it's something that works in your personal life as well as your work life. There's so many times where you're with the wrong girlfriend or you're in some miserable job and you just keep trying to make it better instead of stepping back and saying, should we be doing this at all? And I think doing that as a CEO is my number one job.
When did that become a thing? Right? When did the shift happen from, you know, moving the pixels around and being the operator to having to step back and be the asset allocator?
Well, I think it never becomes one or the other, but I just remember I met Karen Seidenberg. She runs Clear, which are those machines in the airport that get you through security faster. They scan your eyeballs and save you from having to produce your driver's license. And she used to work, I think, at a private equity firm. So I asked her, well, how did you go from being an investor to an operator? And she said, well, it was a grind and I had a bunch of work that I had to do. But now that you have 1,000 or 2,000 people, isn't your job really more like an investor anyway? Aren't you trying to think about how you allocate capital? And I said, hell no. I go into work every day and I roll up my sleeves and I bust my tail. And then she said, well, you might not be doing something right. And I sort of left that breakfast thinking, oh man, I think she's got something on me, because I feel like my secret skill is that I work really hard. I'm not as smart as everybody else, but I'm willing to put in the time. I love Redfin so much that I can overcome some of my genetic deficiencies. But maybe the proper way to think about being a CEO is there's three or four decisions you make every year that you could make in 30 minutes. And if you got all three of them or all four of them right, you would probably be a better leader for your employees, return more money to your investors than if you just grind and get one of those big decisions wrong. And so I just try to recognize when I'm in one of those moments, because you make that decision as quickly as you decide you want a ham sandwich. And you go, whoa. This is not a time to think fast. It's a time to think slow.
Has it been hard to recognize those moments? Because that's that kind of blows my mind to think about. Okay, all you have to do is tune in to when you might be in one of those moments. But then it sounds so simple, but it also sounds incredibly hard.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jeff Bezos has a good paradigm around one-way and two-way doors, where most of the decisions shouldn't be overanalyzed. And you should have a bias for speed, because you can just unwind it. You can try it, and if it doesn't work, you don't do it. I think the only caveat I have to that is that it's really hard to kill a business once it's generating revenue. So you think, well, if we don't like that business, we'll get out of it. But you get addicted to the revenue. And it's sort of built into your costs, where there's a bunch of people who are earning a salary to support that business. And so as an allocator of capital, it's just changing a cell in a spreadsheet. But as an operator, it's telling people you don't have a job anymore. You've got to find another role. And that can be hard. I just feel careful about which businesses we spin up and when. And right now, there's just so much capital in the space. Zillow just did a $1 billion convertible note. Compass is worth $6.5 billion and has raised a couple billion, I think. And then we've got Opendoor and a dozen other real estate tech companies coming into the space. It used to be that nobody wanted to touch the space with a 10-foot pole, and now it's on like Donkey Kong.
Does that validate, like, you've been at this for 14 years, now all this capital is flooding in?
Well, it would validate us if it was all our money. No, I think it's partial validation and partial terrifying competition. There is a consensus on Wall Street that real estate is going to change. There wasn't that consensus a few years ago. I think there was $30 million of private capital going into real estate technology in 2012. And now there's, I think, $4.5 billion or something like that. So people love to throw around the term orders of magnitude, but this is several orders of magnitude. And I think it's because everybody sees that this is a massive part of commerce. It's about a third of GDP. And it's ripe for innovation. And the question is, not everybody's going to win. You know, the shiitake mushrooms are going to hit the fan. And you like to think that you are the fan, but maybe you're the mushroom. And that can be a game of Russian roulette. But when you ask, well, are you tired? Are you thinking about leaving? Like, oh my God, not now. It's game on. So there's nowhere I'd rather be, and there's no company that I think has a better competitive position. But it doesn't mean that victory is vouchsafed to us, we have to hustle our tail off.
And you're not the fan or the shiitake mushroom. You're the rabid squirrel. Can you tell that story? Like, yeah, how did that come to be? Because I locked onto that. Maybe other people don't, but at least I'm super interested in where the rabid squirrel came from and why you embraced it.
Well, it came from a Michael Arrington post. He was the editor of TechCrunch. And at some point when he was writing about us, somebody said, well, how could they possibly win? They've only raised a few million bucks and there's a million real estate agents in the United States. And he posted this deranged picture of a jogger being attacked by a rabid squirrel. And he said, this is who Redfin is. And I think he did that based on the fact that I told him I'd slept on a couch before the interview, or that I took a Greyhound bus on a business trip. I can't remember, but he just decided that he liked the cut of our coat because we were really scrappy. And you always worry at every startup as it matures into a more successful company that you're going to lose your edge. Boxers never win a championship once they've been sleeping in silk sheets. And so you've got to stay feisty. You've got to stay ferocious. And you've got to care about money because we are in a margin-sensitive business. We're trying to give the consumer a better deal. And sooner or later, a price war depends on your cost structure. And I used to think of that as something you could figure out later. But it's actually a habit, a discipline of mind that has to be built into how the whole company runs, where every single time you hire an engineer or a marketer or a salesperson or anyone, you say, well, do we really need that person? We want investors to know that we're going to spend their money wisely, that we're going to be total tightwads, because to be able to give the consumer a good deal and still give the investor a return, you've got to be really disciplined. You've got to pick your spots as an allocator of capital and have the right projects. You've got to treat your employees right because they walk out the door every night and you can't just pay them a king's ransom to come back. They have to want to come back. So I think we've always had this humility that we ain't the prettiest boy or girl in the classroom. We aren't, you know, God's gift to software or real estate. We're going to have to work for it.
Mm-hmm. But why not just frugality? Why rabid squirrel?
Well, because one is easier to remember than the other. I think it can be a little twee or cute. So sometimes I feel embarrassed having it out there in public. But you'll find out that somebody booked a night at the Mandarin in New York City. And you're just like, dude, rabid squirrel. And I guess you could say dude frugality, but rapid squirrel seems to have more impact.
Yeah. Frugality just doesn't resonate in that context as well. No, I loved it. I loved the way that you wrote that sort of your letter and the team in the S1. I read that a few times. It had feeling to it. Did you take a lot of time in writing that? Was that something that you had to think about and put a lot of cycles into, or it just kind of flow out one day and it's like, okay, we're done, file this thing?
Well, first of all, it was the product of the whole team. It wasn't just me, but I did draft the first version at a coffee shop on 19th, just on a Sunday afternoon, because we decided that we didn't need to do the letter. And then at the last moment, Anthony Kappas, our general counsel, said, I think it would be better if there was something about who this company really is. I'll talk to the lawyers, because at this point, nobody wanted any more revisions. Nobody wanted anything else to go to the SEC. I have to get reviewed 20 times. But he said it's worth it. And I was glad I had somebody like that on my side, because it really became the tale of our tribe, where the whole team worked on it. And it was an expression that came from all of us about capitalism with a conscience, about frugality, about being candid and soulful, and making sure that when we went to go sell our stock, that we didn't sell out, that there are people you meet where they should not buy your stock. And people love to complain about how awful it is in the public markets and how investors are short-sighted. I do not feel that way at all. You get the investors you deserve. If you go out there on the road and you say, we are going to kill it, we're going to return massive amounts of capital in our first quarter, well, you're going to get a bunch of hedge funders in your stock who expect that and have every reason to expect that, because you're trying to bid yourself up. But if you say, look, there's going to be some ups and downs, but this is fundamentally a good company trying to do a good thing. And if you're not in that for the long haul, where we're going to take care of employees and pay for healthcare for our real estate agents, and we're going to do the right thing by diversity, and all of that is going to limit short-term returns, but allow for durable returns, long-term growth, don't buy the stock. And so I think we had that moment where we had to decide what kind of investor we wanted. And since then, I've been really glad. I've never felt that our investors have asked us to do anything that was contrary to our values because we always told them what they were.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And I'm curious, did you start that practice early, like in the Series A and B? Did you yeah. have that clarity and that tone about, hey, if you're in it for the long haul and if you want an enduring company, then invest in our Series A? Like, no. did you get people to sign up for that early?
I mean, I think we did that unintentionally, mm-hmm. where we were incredibly unsuccessful at raising capital in the early rounds because we wanted to employ real estate agents. We wanted to pay them a salary and healthcare benefits. And venture capitalists aren't used to giving money to anyone but software engineers. And so we didn't expect the pitch to be such a bomb, but it did not go well. We had a really hard time. In fact, the only person who's ever had more VCs say no, whom I've met, is the person running Peloton. If I went on a run with an entrepreneur or somebody who had raised capital for their company, I'd say, oh, I bet more people have said no to me than to you. And I always won that war until I met, I think his name is John, because he was like selling, you know, this dust gathering exercise equipment as a social network. He was trying to convince you that a treadmill was Facebook. And that was a hard sell. It turned out, by the way, that Tiger Global invested in them and invested in us. Sort of the first people to believe in us in a big way was the same guy, Lee Fixel.
So you mentioned humility a minute ago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it comes up in your letter in your S1. It comes up in a lot of your speaking. I wanted to dig in on that and just ask, what is humility and why does that matter in building a company?
Well, you have to have some chutzpah. You got to think that you can build a better mousetrap than anybody else. And as you get middle-aged like I am, you also know, you remember all of your failures and you're just kind of crippled by them. You know, you'll be walking across a parking lot just with a happy smile on your face, and then you'll suddenly think about something stupid you said at a party or a product you really believed would work that was a total bomb. And you just stop and you feel like, I can't even walk to the bus. I am so ashamed. And so I think humility is important because Silicon Valley can be a little bit douchey. Tech can be a little bit entitled. And it's important because when you're a CEO, you get surrounded by people who want to give you good news. And just more and more, you hear what you want to hear. And so you have to have a culture of dissent where people can tell you things that are awful to hear. You have to subject your deepest held convictions to the possibility that you are totally wrong. And you just have to remember that no matter how smart people say I am, I still got to hustle for it. And so, you know, what's saying here is that everybody sweeps the floors. It's just another simple way to remind the executives that if you want to take on airs, if you want to be a big shot, go work somewhere else. Because I can't ask somebody else to work hard if I'm not willing to work hard. I can't ask somebody else to do some crappy job unless I do that myself. And I think that has allowed us to grow and still have, you know, a good culture.
So you mentioned that some of it's about accepting that a deepest held conviction could be proven wrong.
Yeah.
Have you had any moments of that happening along the way?
Yeah. I mean, in my 20s, I'd started this company called Plumtree, and we had these little snippets of web code that you can embed on a web page called a gadget. And I wanted them to be syndicated from one website. It's this crazy idea. And I was the founder of the company. I had a lot of moral authority. Nobody thought it was a good idea. And I got them all to do it. And it was this massive commercial failure. And so whenever I have another idea that I fall in love with, I think it could be like that. It could be syndicated gadgets. So there are a lot of people in America right now who are really frustrated, who think the world would run perfectly if only someone would listen to me. And I wish they could have that experience of absolute power, where you see this beautiful idea leave your head and become this misshapen, evil thing that you just want to flush down the toilet. And then you realize, like, we're all trying to make things better, and some work and some don't, and it's very unpredictable, and you learn humility.
I've certainly had those experiences as well.
And, yeah.
You know, you sort of draw them back in, you know, next time something comes up or you fall in love with an idea. I'm also curious, do you have any ways that you build habits or practices? How do you bring that focus on humility into your daily life? Like, how does it show up at a day-to-day level?
First of all, you're probably not as much of a dipstick as I am. So you don't have as many people just giving you a funny look when you say, what about this idea? I don't even know where to start. I don't think many of us have a spouse who worships the ground we walk on. My wife loves me dearly and I love her, but we're real partners. And I say, oh, I'm really excited about this idea. What do you think? And then she says, I think it's terrible, Glenn. I love you, but it's terrible. And now, every once in a while, I'll have an idea or the company will do something really important and I won't have run it by Sylvia. And she's like, whoa, you sure you want to do that? Because she's been such a great partner to me, where she has really helped me figure things out. And I think the other part of that is that there is this meanness to American business now where the CEO is on the cover, the CEO is in the podcast, but Bridget Fry, Adam Weiner, Scott Nagel, Annie Hatcher, Chris Nielsen, Anthony Kappas, we've been together for a long time. And they can just come in and say, dude, no, that is so bad. And I think if we had a new executive team who didn't know me from way back when, they might be more deferential in ways that are actually devastating, you know, where bad ideas do come to life because no one, like, do you remember when you saw, I mean, maybe this is dating myself, but was it the fourth Star Wars movie with Jar Jar Binks? It was just proof positive that George Lucas had surrounded himself with sycophants. Or is it sycophants? Like, no one could tell him, that's racist, dude. That is terrible. It's embarrassing. And so you have to have people around you who don't think you walk on water. And that isn't hard for me to do. To know me is to know that I don't.
And a lot of those people on your leadership team have been here
eight,
10, like, 12 years.
Yeah, we're in this together. We built this together. I didn't do it. We did it.
Does anybody ask you, entrepreneurs ask you, you know, hey, I'm starting to build my leadership team. Maybe I've raised my A or my B. How can I get to where you are with them, where they do challenge me and where they do create that forcing function to have that humility?
Well, I mean, part of it is trial and error, where you hire people who are incredibly intelligent and confident and opinionated, but also have some chemistry with you. I really missed going from Plumtree to Redfin. I missed co-founders. Kirill and Joe were the co-founders at Plumtree, and they could kind of come into my office or put an arm around my shoulder. I could do the same to them and say, I know you love this, but you gotta let it go. It's a really bad idea. And at first, I just felt really lonely because I missed Kirill and Joe. And then, you know, a bunch of people came on board who had that history with me or who developed that history with me. And Redfin was much better off once those people had more influence at Redfin. So I think it's trial and error. There was one time where there was a role where I'd fired two or three people. And I felt like I just couldn't fire another one because it was such a black eye on the company. And I felt so ashamed that I still hadn't been able to hire this person. And I sat down with a friend of mine who just said Lincoln fired five generals until he got Ulysses S. Grant. And you just have to do it. Like, you're a screw up and a dingbat. You've ruined two people's lives or three, but you got to find somebody who's a real partner to you. And some of that is that you can't really be an autocrat. I cringe whenever I hear a CEO say, I got to get another $10 million in revenue. I shipped that product. I did almost anything. The only time you should use the word I is to say I screwed up. And the more you can model that in a company where you can say in front of everybody, that was me, that was me. And there are so many times where I feel like that's my job. It's time to step into it. It's bullshit. That was somebody else's idea. And I'm just going to own it. And as I say it, I go through this process of almost Christian grace of thinking, wait a minute, I think that was actually my idea, or I approve that idea, or I endorse that idea, where you remember that you're in charge of everything. And there was this one time where it was not my idea and the board wanted me to do it and it didn't work, probably because I made sure it wasn't going to work. And then I said, I never liked that idea anyway. It was the board who made me do it. And it was this message to the rest of the company, Glenn's not even in charge, that if you don't like something or if you want to get an idea approved, you got to go to the board. And I hope I've never made that mistake again. Like the worst part about it is I brought it back to them where I never said, this was your idea. I just presented the results of this project that pretty much been their idea. And I'm like, yeah, this is failing. What do you think we ought to do? And I'm sort of like bouncing in my seat. Like this is going to be the moment where they say, I'm so sorry. We should have never forced you to do that. Of course you should cancel it. And they're like, you idiot. Why did you do that? And I'm like, oh, yeah, all right. We'll nuke it. So you're going down for a bad idea. You should make sure that you own it.
On the flip side, then, how do you celebrate the good stuff? Is it the opposite, then, where you're sort of putting wind in the sail? I've heard you talk about being a cheerleader.
Yeah, I don't do that enough. I think what's hard about being an entrepreneur or a CEO is you're this idealist at one level where you imagine this perfect world where real estate is reinvented or whatever product you're trying to build has totally changed the galaxy. And then the distance between that and where you are right now makes you impossible to please. You're just this incredibly driven person who is constantly dismayed that reality isn't better, isn't perfect. And at the same time, there are people who are working their tail off and you need to be getting out the cheerleading pom-poms and jumping up and down for them. And so being impossible to please and driven and ambitious and passionate about the company and also saying, oh, that's a lot better than anything else we've ever done. Way to go. That's a balance that everybody struggles with. And it's a balance that I struggle with all the time. And I try sometimes at the end of the day to remember to catch people doing good things. Like, you know, you look at something and you're expecting that they didn't do this and they didn't do that. And then they did. But you never say, oh, well, thanks for doing that. You just sort of take it for granted. So I don't know. It's hard.
I've heard you say that, you know, your job has changed from like doing work to you're kind of a cheerleader.
Yeah.
How does that change in terms of how you measure yourself? And I don't mean measure in terms of a spreadsheet deck, but just how you kind of reflect on,
man, you
am I doing a good job?
Yeah. I think the anecdote you may have heard was that I've come home and told my wife they shouldn't even call work work. They should call it talk because all I do is talk all day. And the way I measured my productivity and my sense of self-worth was just keystrokes per minute. And I'd barely typed it all that day. And she would say, good, good. Now you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. So that is only partially true. Everything that I just told you actually happened. But I need some time to do what I really love. I've talked to engineers who really miss coding now that they're in management. And I say, well, you just need a couple hours a day where you've blocked your calendar and you're able to do code reviews. You're able to write some code. I think if you're going to become a chief technology officer at our scale, you probably can't be doing check-ins anymore. But somehow you have to break problems down into the pieces you're used to working with. So for example, I like writing. And when I'm trying to make one of those decisions, as an allocator of capital that we were talking about earlier, other people might draw a diagram, or other people might make a PowerPoint, or other people might find other people to talk to about it. But for me, I write the pro and the con down, and I see which document is more compelling. That's the way I slow my thinking down. That's the way I turn a problem into something that has, you know, a surface area I can grab onto. So I still structure my day so that I get to do the things that I love, because sooner or later you're doing a bunch of other things that you don't love. And I like talking to people and I like being in meetings, but if I do that all day, I'm not my best self. And so I just like, oh, well, I just need to watch that.
So you actually write up like the investment case for a new business, or write up sort of the pros and the cons on a decision?
Yeah, I will. And the two other documents that I have to produce every quarter with a team are the earnings script and the board document. We don't use much PowerPoint or Google Slides in a board document. We We write out, this is our point of view on this business. This is what's really going on in the business, because that's the proper subject of a board meeting. You're not tap dancing for the board and hoping to avoid getting fired or trying to get a gold star. You're trying to have a real discussion about what's going on in the business so that you can get real help. And to do that, you have to sort of pull together the tail of the tribe. And it's incredibly useful because a lot of times before the board meeting even starts, you're like writing this story and you're like, that doesn't make any sense. If you were like making a movie, nobody would believe it. And then you realize, oh my God, that's so stupid. We got to change that. So we sort of pull together that story. And then when we come into the board meeting, first of all, we've already learned a lot. But second of all, the blinds are up. The board meeting members aren't like looking at their phone, you know, while slide after slide is up on the screen. We're like, okay, so what do you think? Should we invest in this business? And you want to reserve the right to make that decision. The executive team and the CEO should make that decision, but you want them to really give you good advice. So doing that and then doing the same thing, I almost wish that I had to write an earnings script when we were private, because when you rationalize all your investments, you realize how many are irrational, and it's quite clarifying. So I don't know if you felt that way when you raised money, but I always felt that when we went out on the road, I'm like, what a crock. I'm going to drag my sorry ass all over Sand Hill Road, talk to these guys in suspenders. And actually, they're really bright people who have seen a lot of different businesses. And the questions they ask, you come back and you're like, oh, there's three or four things we ought to do different. Don't tell anyone. I learned that from a VC. but you do.
Just a very 101 question. What is an earnings script?
Well, you have a call every quarter with investors. Some people just put what you're going to say on that call in a blog post and then say, any questions? We read the script, which I find a little bit weird. Chris, our CFO, likes it. And I really don't do much investor relations. I've got an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old, and my wife works more than full time. So when people say, oh, I want to talk to you, I'm your fourth largest shareholder, I say, I really put a lot of energy explaining exactly what's going on with this business in that script. You should go read it. It's up there on Seeking Alpha or some other Wall Street website. It's also on our investor relations site. And then call me if you have any questions, because otherwise it's just a Reg FD violation waiting to happen. And that's where I give one investor some information that other investors don't have. And so, yeah, you just put a lot of energy. Like, let's just do it once and do it right. This is what's going on in the business. This is where we screwed up. This is where we're really excited.
Mm-hmm. So you would, if you were going back in time, would you, you know, do a process like that as a private company just for the exercise?
Yeah. I mean, your board meeting is sort of that.
Yeah.
But somewhere you should write down in a couple of pages, here's what's going on. This is what's going well. This is what's not going well. You know, with your board instead of investors, you might also talk about, you know, personnel decisions. And then you notice, oh, I talked about that the last one and the one before that and the one before that. Maybe I ought to do something. But it helps just to build that narrative, because mostly we just keep doing the same stuff every day, hoping for a different result. And having to stand and deliver an account of the business forces you to step back and see it strategically.
Mm-hmm. I've heard you say that some of the stagecraft of being a CEO, you're not in love with. And, you know, sort of the jobs and the Elon Musk ideal of the CEO doesn't resonate with you. How do you separate out things like that that have this real intrinsic value, right? But they're sort of part of the job, from sort of the stagecraft stuff that, you know, sort of people idealize about the CEO.
Maybe I've come full circle on that. So I still feel that there is this imperial CEO who is overvalued, that the value of a company is all the work of the employees and not just one person, and it leads to CEOs being overpaid, overhyped, overvalued in society. But I remember once there was an executive who wasn't a great public speaker, and the board was really focused on that issue. And I just said, that is such a crock. This person runs his or her business to perfection. Such a badass. And all you care about is how that person shows up on a stage. And a board member later on kind of cornered me and said, it's not a crock. Like if you're running an organization that has more than 10 people in it, sooner or later, you have a one-to-many communication and people have got to want to take that hill. And just because you take it for granted doesn't mean that other people can. And you just need to work on it with that person. And so I used to feel that being inspirational was something you either had or you hadn't. And actually, you can break it down into pieces. Somebody who is a total dud may never be Ronald Reagan or Barack Obama, but they can get a lot better. And having the board get in my grill about that and say, you should take it seriously instead of saying in a podcast like this that it totally doesn't matter. I now have come around to that. I agree with that. So I just think that there are just so many days where I give a barn burner of a speech and somebody comes up to me afterwards and says, you seem like such a great CEO, but the hour before I took the stage, I was a terrible CEO. And I don't quite feel like a fraud, but I just think you should follow me around for a week. And I don't know. I just don't want the press or investors to over-index on that 1 hour. That's just one part of it. And the other part of it is how you make people feel and whether you hire well and the decisions that you make and all the rest.
It's a great point. And as an entrepreneur, it also is a good reminder not to yourself over-index on that.
Oh,
right?
Dude, you could never. You are a natural. I mean, seriously. If I had your tools, I'd go crazy. I would.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you. All right. I want to be mindful of your time.
Yeah.
I have six rapid fire questions call the Supersonic Six for max corniness for a Seattle podcast. They're fast questions. You can give longer answers if you want.
All they right.
However long you want to spend. So number one, what's the one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
We need more people to leave Amazon and Microsoft and start their own thing. I don't want to be colonized by a bunch of tech companies from Silicon Valley. I want to colonize them.
Love it. Okay. Number two, if you could go back to the beginning, would you still found your company in Seattle?
I didn't found Redfin, but I am so glad we're here. 100%. It still has a little working class grit, and it's got a lot of tech razzle-dazzle, and that's a potent combo.
Number three, who's a Seattle company or founder that you're following or studying right now and why?
Shahir Kabani, Sandy Lin, Dan Lewis, Rich Barton.
Okay. For one of those on the list, why? Why did they get like rise above the noise to be on your radar as, hey, I need to watch what they're doing?
Sandy Lin at Skilljar is an absolute badass. She is going to be an amazing, amazing CEO of a huge company. And I'm just really excited to see her get the chance. I don't know. She's just got an incredible amount of joy and intensity and energy, and she's learning super fast. It's really fun. I also love Matt Williams over at Pro. I think he's doing an amazing job there.
Perfect. Shout out to Sandy. She's going to be on this podcast. Number four, what's a truth you know that other people think is false?
Most people think shame is a purely negative or bad emotion. But I would say we live in a shameless time and that people in power, like me, should feel a sense of shame when we have done something wrong because there's almost no other check on our money and our power.
That's deep. Boom. Exploding emoji.
All right.
What do you know today that you'd wish you'd known when you started at Redfin?
Get enough sleep.
And last one, what ask do you have for this audience? What can this community do to help you?
Buy and sell houses from Redfin.
Very simple. I love it. Thank you, Glenn. This is amazing. I've learned a ton from you.
All right. I'm out of here.
Drop the mic.